call the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee to order. Welcome, everyone. We are going to be, well, first of all, I want to announce that we are going to set over House Bill 3056 and Senate Bill 878 till Tuesday's session. Now, Senate Bill 878 is also on Thursday, House Bill 3056 is also on Thursday's schedule, but if we can get things done by Tuesday, we'll take it up then. Otherwise, we'll stick with our Thursday date. So Bill 878 and House Bill 3056 are set over till Tuesday, and we are currently going to open a work session on House Bill 2067A, and I'd like to invite Jules Bailey up to the podium.
He was here for 878. Just kind of talking to him, so he may have left. That was his primary interest.
Okay.
Madam Chair, the bills I was here to testify on and then held over.
Okay, thank you, Jules. Okay. We are in work session on House Bill 2067, on which we had a hearing, I believe it was last week. So Chris, let us know about our dash, I believe, 9 amendment to this.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. The dash A9 amendment, which you should have in your packet, you have the dash A9 amendment and a revenue impact statement and fiscal impact statement for that dash A9. And then you should also have what I guess refer to as a cheat sheet on the dash A9 amendment that shows the groups of the tax expenditures and their sunset dates. What the dash A9 primarily does is change the structure for the sunset dates. 2067A groups the tax expenditures into sunsetting in 2014, 2016, and 2018. The dash A9 moves everything up 2 years so they become so that they sunset in 2012, 2014, or 2016. Other changes in the dash A9 in Section 25 is the rural medical credit, and what that does, in addition to creating the sunset, there's language that says that a taxpayer who is eligible for that credit for tax year 2013, if and when the credit does sunset, that they are able, whoever was eligible in 2013, can continue to be eligible for 10 years as long as they meet whatever eligibility requirements exist. So no new people would be allowed to claim it, but if you're in the program and you continue to meet the requirements for providing rural medical services, you would continue to get the credit for 10 years through tax year 2022.
So basically the effect of this is in the unlikely event that the program is actually sunsetted, anyone who is currently in the program would have 10 years past that sunset date to remain in the program if they meet the proper requirements.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Okay.
One other thing I wanted to point out on that same page in Section 27 is a credit ORS 315521, and that is the Public University Venture Development Fund. And the sunset date there is January 1, 2016. So in effect, with all of these other changes, that was in 2067A, that was due to sunset on 2016, which was that middle group.
Mm-hmm.
And the dash nines move it to the third group, and in effect, it doesn't change that sunset date.
So it's in the later of the last of the three groups to be sunsetted.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Okay. So with those three changes, that's it for the changes, correct?
Yes.
And then do we have, there was a technical amendment that was needed too. Is that included in this or is that amendment?
No, that's in there, Madam Chair. That is in Section 52 of the bill.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that language was structured in the same language, it referred to a subtraction and a credit. And in the initial drafting of the bill, both of those pieces were sunsetted. And the relating to clause for this bill is relating to tax sunsetting on tax credits. So that's the technical correction, that it ensures that the subtraction is not sunsetted.
Okay.
And that's kind of a truth in lending and being consistent with the relating to clause of the bill, so that only tax credits are affected.
Okay, correct.
Yes, yes, that was the technical correction.
Thank you very much. Senator Hass is the one responsible for the moving up of the sunset years, and Senator Morse and I worked together on the medical rural medical extension, and Senator Morse is responsible for the change in the categorization of the higher education tax credit. So if either of you want to talk about either of those, please feel free, and if not, we'll just move ahead. Senator Hass, did you want to?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I thought that we should get to these sooner, because if we don't, you have this opposite effect of what this bill is trying to do, of actually lengthening tax credits that were that would have sunsetted earlier. If they're supposed to sunset at 2012 and they're not going to be worked on until 2018, it has almost the opposite effect what this bill is intended to do. And so by moving it up the schedule 2 years, you minimize that, even though there's still a little bit of that left. And I understand that the ramifications of doing that creates in out years a revenue impact, and I understand, and that does require a 3/5 vote, but that presupposes that we will not re-up any of these tax credits, which I think is very unlikely. We will just give them more scrutiny, and maybe there will be some that will be taken off or not upped, but I just think it makes more sense to get it this sooner rather than to put it off to what 18? That'd be 9 years in 2018 that we're starting to look at this. We can do better than that.
We certainly can. We are the great Finance and Revenue Committee. Thank you, Senator Morris. Did you want to make any comments about?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the change or the amendment with respect to the rural medical. That's a major issue in this state, is attracting physicians to rural Oregon and having the certainty for those that make that commitment that will be, they know what it will be, I think is very, very important. And I'm very appreciative of that. With respect to the minor change of the University Venture Development Fund, that was a bill that I created, worked very hard on, and was implemented. But it was presented in the context of it's not going to be, it'd be highly unlikely that it would be a quick return on essentially that investment. The investment does have, the tax expenditure is capped, and I wanted to make sure that evaluation period we had the longest possible seasoning of that. So that's why I had asked for that change, and I appreciate incorporating it.
Thank you. I really am pleased by these constructive changes to the bill. I think they make it a stronger bill. And what this bill is about, the bill and the amendment, is really about fiscal accountability. We have a ways and means process where we review all our out-of-general fund expenditures every 2 years. But until now, we've not had an orderly process for regularly evaluating our tax credit programs to make sure that they are serving their purpose, that the taxpayers are getting their money's worth, because these cost money just as much as an expenditure for a program costs. So I'm glad it's made it this far. I'm really happy to see the support on the committee. And so with that, Senator Morse, do you have... Oh, wait a minute, we have a...
I just wanted to, Madam Chair,
yeah.
Just want to comment on the revenue impact statement you have in here. It shows a positive revenue impact, getting back to Senator Hass's point, of $59 million in 11-13 and $113 million. And so that does the positive revenue impact, turns it into the 3/5 requirement. I also, please note the preliminary label on that. As we're going through this, I have a nagging feeling that those revenue impacts don't adjust for the change in the rural medical credit. So I think those will change a little bit in the final impact statement.
That's correct. And that would change most likely in the direction of being less of a revenue generator, correct?
That's correct.
And again, committee, we all understand that the revenue impact is assuming that these are all going to go away, and these all have constituencies and the likelihood of them going away.
I think, Madam Chair, that you are seeing that just with this rural tax credit,
yes.
That the potential for these being so impossible to do one by one, to repeal them or not reinstate them when they are scheduled to sunset. And I will guarantee you that as this works its way to the Senate floor and over to the House, we will probably hear from 51 constituencies about how important they're, and that's a good thing. You know, those are the same kinds of dynamics that occur in the ways and means process, and that is what we need. And that's, as this points out, the purpose of this bill is to enable a systematic review in a structured way. So,
and so I want to thank everyone who's helped on this, and Representative Bailey is not in the room anymore, but he played a key role in organizing the categories over in the House and putting this into a bill that makes sense from a policy perspective as well as from a fiscal perspective. So with that, Senator Morse, we have a Dash 9 amendment that it contains everything we're trying to do here.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 9 amendments to House Bill 2067.
Senator Morse has moved the Dash 9 amendments to House Bill 2067. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Morse.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2067 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morse has moved House Bill 2067 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Morse, would you like to co-carry this with me?
Sure.
Senator Morse and I will co-carry House Bill 2067. Okay. Committee, I've received a couple of notes, and there are people who showed up here to talk about House Bill 3056. So instead of putting it over, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3056. Yes, why not? We are going to have a very brief summary since the chair is clearly not on our game today and the appropriate staff left, so our good Chris is going to fill in here. So Chris, take it away.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the bill amends statutes relating to urban renewal plans and the maximum amount of indebtedness that may be issued or incurred under the plan. It sets initial maximum indebtedness for the plans and establishes an indexing scheme for increasing that maximum. It requires concurrence of overlapping taxing districts for substantial plan amendments, increases the max, and that increased the indebtedness by more than 20% of the initial indebtedness.
Okay, and this is a subject of a work group that's accomplished what work groups of yore have failed to accomplish. So we are very eager to hear the testimony of those in front of us. So please proceed.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Doug Rux. I'm the president of the Association of Oregon Redevelopment Agencies. I'm briefly going to go through kind of the highlights, the three primary elements that are contained in HB 3056. But first, I need to say that we did spend a significant amount of time over the last months working together in this work group to come up with a proposal. The first issue is the one on maximum indebtedness limitations. What we came up with was effectively three levels, and it's related to your frozen base amount. So in a frozen base, you could have a maximum indebtedness amount of $50 million with a frozen base of $50 million. The next level is that you could have a maximum indebtedness amount of up to $100 million if you have a frozen base level between $50 million and $150 million. And the third level is if you have a maximum indebtedness amount above $150 million, you can have the $100 million plus 35% of your frozen base amount. So there's three levels that exist in that. There's also a provision that allows that you can go to the overlapping taxing districts with concurrence, 75% concurrence, and you could exceed those thresholds. This is we would be applying to all new plans that would be created. The second component is one that's on limiting plan amendments. In this, there again, there are two tracks or two levels. The first is you could do a substantial amendment on your maximum indebtedness and increase that by 20% through a confer consult process, which is the same that you do when you create a new urban renewal plan. You could do that in a series of 1, 2, 3, or 4, or whatever, but the aggregate total could not exceed 20%. If you wanted to increase your maximum indebtedness above 20% of your initial existing maximum indebtedness, you would have to go through a concurrence process with the overlapping taxing districts and get that 75% concurrence. The third issue is sharing of the assessed value. In this proposal is that for new plans or increasing of the maximum indebtedness, there would be some sharing and revenue triggers. What effectively this does is that it allows the overlapping taxing district revenues to operate and fund their operations. There are kind of two triggers into this. One is if your maximum indebtedness, you have 10 years to operate your plan with no sharing. In the 11th year, if your maximum indebtedness is 10% or greater, then you start to do sharing, and the agencies get to keep their 10% in order to make their debt service. The second trigger is the 12.5%. At that level of your maximum indebtedness, the overlapping taxing districts would get 100% of the revenue above that 10% in order to do their operations. And we have technical staff here for like some further clarification on that. There are also some housekeeping amendments that are included in this, which deals with some indexing of maximum indebtedness over time and some statutory requirements about when urban renewal agencies have to produce their annual reports. So in brief summary, that's what the context is within HB 3056. Thank you.
Thank you. Why don't we move through the panel and then we'll ask questions.
Madam Chair, I think Mr. Rex covered anything that I would have to say. Unless there's any questions, I'll defer.
Okay, can you identify?
I'm sorry, Alec Jensen, Dwellin Valley Fire and Rescue.
Great, thank you. And are you Mr. Rogers?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Would you please go over for us the representation on the work group that came up with this?
At the risk of possibly leaving somebody out, because it was an extensive list, we have Special Districts Association, Association of Oregon Redevelopment Agencies, League of Cities, Association of Counties, City of Portland, Multnomah County. We had labor representatives. While not party to the memorandum understanding, the Bank of America was present, who issues most urban renewal bonds in Oregon. Myriad technical and legal representation. I did say City of Portland Development Commission. Who did I miss?
We also had Clackamas County was a participant in this, the Oregon Fire District Directors Association, the Oregon Firefighters Association. It was a large working group.
Pretty amazing. And when did you start and when did you finish on this?
Initially, Mr. Jensen and I began meeting back in December, about the time of the snowstorm.
Uh-huh.
And we began working, and we continue to work up and through today. We were meeting on a weekly basis most of the time, working through this and taking it back to our different groups and associations and members and vetting it to see if this would work or if this would not work. There was a lot of tweaking, a lot of hours of discussion.
Okay, well, thank you for the good work. This has eluded many work groups beforehand, the whole urban renewal area, partly because of its complexity. There is going to be a small amendment from the Portland School District. Are you aware of that amendment that will be coming, and do you have any concerns?
Chair Burke, yes, we are aware of that amendment. It appears that it would address the issue within the City of Portland and Portland Development Commission. So from AORA's perspective, that provision, that gap measure, doesn't apply outside of the Portland Public Schools.
Okay, so you don't have concerns in terms of your overall product here?
Madam Chair, the only caveat, we haven't seen it.
Correct. Nobody has. But I just wanted to make sure that there are no concerns surfacing yet. Okay, and then we do have an amendment, dash 7, I think, don't we, on this? Could you go over what this dash 7 amendment accomplishes?
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Harvey Rogers. I'm a lawyer with K&L Gates. We serve as bond counsel to a lot of the participants, and I was engaged by the City of Portland to help with the legislative drafting. The dash 7 amendments are purely technical. It's a long, complicated bill, and they pick up slight glitches that we didn't get addressed on the House side. Happy to go through them if you like, but there's nothing of substance in them.
I think we can go with that now, unless committee members have questions. When this comes up for work session, we can go into the amendment in more depth. Okay, questions from the committee? No brave souls? Questions on urban renewal? Okay, thank you very much. These are all the people that I have signed up for House Bill 3056. Is there anybody else out there who would like to testify? Okay, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3056. Again, I apologize for the switch signals here. Now we will open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 976. That's yours. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Senate Bill 976 deals with the 10th grade assessment testing, and it makes a couple of changes to that. Currently, the Department of Education can grant a waiver to school districts for the 08-09 year to use their own assessment test rather than the state assessment test. What the bill does is to allow the department to continue to grant waivers to eligible school districts that request a waiver, and the school district with a waiver can contract with its own testing entity, different from that used by the Department of Revenue. But the districts that have to meet certain criteria, and one of them is that they have to have used an alternative test in 07-08 and meet certain other criteria. What is one of the big differences is that it would now require the Department of Education to reimburse these districts that use the waiver process for their assessment costs, and that money then would have to come out of that $550,000 of state school fund monies that's set aside to pay for the testing. And that comes directly out of the state school fund money that would otherwise be available to education service districts. So assuming that some districts would continue to request waivers from the Department of Education, there is a impact on education service districts of about $8,500 a year.
Okay, we've got Representative Wingard on his way, I believe, over here. Paul, do we know when he'll be here? Then I think we'll take our first panel, and then when he comes, he can come up, unless you're speaking for him.
No.
Okay. We'll have John Bridges and Ozzie Rose. Welcome to the committee.
Malcolm, thank you. For the record, my name is Ozzy Rose. I'm with Martinez & Sons, and we represent districts who use the alternative test and are interested in continuing to do so. Mr. Bridges represents one of those districts. I'm going to talk to you about the bill and what we did and what we've got or proposing to do. Mr. Bridges will talk to you about the actual testing stuff, which I know very little about. First of all, I think most of you know that in 2007, the legislature passed a statute that required the Department of Ed to contract with an entity to administer a nationally normed assessment to all students in grade 10. It actually says make available to all students in grade 10. That process was put out for bid and or an RFP, and the entity was chosen. The 13 school districts, actually 15, had started using this type of test before the legislature passed its mandate. And we were successful during the short session in 08 of getting a waiver for those districts that chose to have it waivered and use their own, not their own, but another test like it that met all the criteria of the test described in the RFP. And if they tested, used those tests in 07, 08, they could apply for a waiver for 08, 09. And we now come to 2009, and those districts are interested in being able to continue using an alternative to what's purchased by the state. And I'll go through some numbers as why that is true. By the way, there are 45,000 10th graders. And last year, the 2,600, almost 2,700, 27,000, excuse me, were tested under the test by the state's contractor. And the students in the waiver district, there are 8,400 were tested. So about 17%, 18% of the kids tested are in those waiver districts. 10,000 students were not tested in any manner, which represents about a fourth of all of the testers. 10 districts that were using the test in 08-09 waiver began nationally using test. One started in 05-06, one started in 06-07, and eight started in 07-08. So they have a history and a database of several years, which they are able to use with, one, helping their students, and two, helping the district make appropriate changes in their curriculum and teaching methodology. And John will talk to you some about that. In addition to the grade 10 test, the districts that were involved in this prior to the state mandate tested several grade levels. And on my testimony, it's written, it shares with you that Beaverton, Monroe, Sherwood, Tigard, and Bend all tested 8, 9, 10, and 11. And if the purpose of these tests is to help the kids know what they can and can't do when they reach graduation. Obviously, if you start in the eighth grade, you'll help them all through their high school experience. The cost of the test, mentioned that comes out of some money that's been taken or set aside from the ESDs. The test given by the contracted test runs $11 a student. The test given by the waiver districts runs from $8.50 to $9.50, depending on some factors and the volume, so forth. The funding for the state contracted test comes from money that's set aside from the ESD funds. So all of these districts that are hiring their own test situation pay not only for the test, but they lose services from their ESD because of the money being removed. And I shared with you a table there that shows you, and I have the value of lost services. It varies. I mean, there's a range, and the range takes into effect how many were actually tested this past year versus what the price would be if they actually tested all the other kids. And Beaverton, the cost of giving the test to their 10th graders was $26,000. They also lost $19,000 in services from their ESD, and had the state tested all the people they could test, they would have lost $25,000. Essentially, they pay for the test twice. And if you go through and look at the numbers, they're different sizes or different amounts because of districts, but proportionally are all about the same. 976 will allow the waiver districts to continue getting a waiver on an annual basis So if the state at any time wants to change and move to a different approach to testing, they would not have to give the waiver. And it allows those districts to be treated in the same way in terms of the financing. The State Board of Education has, at its March meeting, unanimously supported the language that's in 1976. One of the questions arose when I around talked to you, well, why, if we don't do this, why can't the districts go ahead and test anyway? And they can. They could give the, and they're all using testing the ACT company. They could continue to give that, pay for it themselves, but they would also have to make available the other test for all of their students. So, and by the way, besides that, they test all of the kids in Oregon 10th grade under the Oregon testing program, OAKS. And so if you chose to use the waiver, do the state test, you can't choose that, you have to, and follow this mandate, your sophomores will be tested three times, and the tests are a half a day or so of disruption for the school. Their other option is to drop what they're doing and just go with the test that the state is asking to do or funding. And the problem with this is the work they've done over all these years and the value of this kind of test would be lost to those school districts. Fiscal is minimal. The money's already set aside. The tests under the waiver group are less expensive than the others. The opponents listed a number of things on the previous testimony about why you should not do this. One, that the vendor has a state contract, and they did. They put out an RFP, but they have an annual contract that's renewable at the same conditions. So their contract ends in June of this year. Another argument is that a single test gives statewide data and we could use it for analysis. The State Department has not, does not, and plan to ever use this data. They have the taste tests that they administer for the purposes that are required by the feds, and they do not use this data. I will stop there and answer any questions. Madam Chair.
Thank you. Let's take our next witness, and then we will take questions.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, I'm John Bridges, the Administrator for Accountability in the Beaverton School District. I live at 13065 Southwest Falcon Rise Drive in Tigard, and I'm here testifying in support of passage of Senate Bill 976. I just want to add on to what Mr. Rose has already said. Since you're the Revenue Committee, you might want to hear about the revenue side of this. We do have the option of giving the plan, the 10th grade ACT plan test in the spring, and also making available the PSAT test to our students. There are two options for PSAT testing, and that's either to give the test on Wednesday during school or on Saturday, not during school. The issue is if we give the PSAT on Saturday, and we have to give it Wednesday or Saturday without passage of this bill. On Saturday, the district is responsible for providing and paying for proctors for all of the 10th grade students that show up to take the assessment. We believe the intent of the bill was to give every student in Oregon the opportunity to take an assessment that is nationally normed and provides evidence on whether or not that student is ready for college. As Mr. Rose said, that only that 75% of students were tested either by waiver districts or by districts that were participating in the state PSAT assessment. That means 25% of students in the state did not take advantage of that opportunity. In Beaverton, we've been ensuring that all students participate in that assessment of college readiness for 4 years. If we gave the PSAT test on Wednesday, we find that that would be a hardship for our schools. So Mr. Rose talked about the fact that students would be taking three assessments. We already have a spring testing date when we give the ACT test to our 11th graders, and we also give a college readiness test to our 9th graders. So those two groups of students would be testing for half a day, And students that were not, 10th graders and 12th graders, would have their schedule disrupted because you can't hold high school classes that have a mix of 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th graders on a regular bell schedule when half the students are testing. In the fall, we'd have the same disruption because we'd have 10th graders taking the PSAT and the 11th graders, and we have a number in our district that do, that wanted to take the PSAT, they would have to be tested on the same date. College Board has made it clear that if you give the 10th grade test, the 11th grade test has to be the exact same day. So all 10th graders, some 11th graders would be testing on Wednesday, 9th graders, 12th graders, and 11th graders that were not taking the PSAT, knowing full well that we'd still be giving the plan in the spring, would have to have a disrupted schedule for that day. So we're talking about a significant loss of instructional time if we do not have, if Senate Bill 976 does not pass and we give the PSAT on Wednesday, and we're talking about unequal access and an inefficient use of public funds, in our opinion, if Senate Bill 976 does not pass and we give the PSAT on Saturday. I did want to talk about why this data is so important to us. It's not just a matter of we've been giving this test for 4 years and we don't want to change. That's not it at all. On the first page of my testimony down at the bottom, I've talked about some of the uses of the individual student data. We've used that data, unlike the state, to make decisions to help improve the education of our students. So we both use the data to identify students that could participate in more rigorous coursework that are traditionally overlooked or may not be explicitly encouraged to participate in college-level coursework. We also use it to identify students that need additional assistance to be either successful in high school or another setting. The last bullet on page one talks about that we look for those students that have high 10th grade scores, so they're demonstrating college readiness, but their GPAs do not match that level of achievement. So something in our comprehensive high schools are not working for those students, so we put them, we use that as a screen to see if it would be a better placement for them to be at community college. And the students that we're sending to PCC in our early college high school program are experiencing success. So if we didn't have this college readiness data, we identified what a score is that helps a student be successful in another setting, we would have to start using the PSAT and do that work all over again. And in the meantime, we'd be losing the opportunity to place students in that program. The State Board last week has adopted both plan and ACT scores as evidence that students are demonstrating essential skills in reading and applying mathematics. So it seems that if students are able to satisfy graduation requirements with the plan assessment, that it would be important for the legislature to help schools any way that they can to give an assessment that provides evidence of their readiness for graduation. On the top of the second page, you have an example of the fact that we have loaded our 9th grade Explore, 10th grade Plan, and our 11th grade ACT test data, as well as our 8th grade Explore data, into our data warehouse. So teachers are able to call up this college readiness testing data on any student that they have and see the student's current scores, as well as their prior scores, and compare that to whether the student is meeting a college readiness benchmark on those assessments. Second, we use the data to assess our school and district progress to close the achievement gap and increase student achievement. Our board is, their current draft of our next five-year goal is that all students will show continuous progress towards their personal learning goals and will be prepared for post-secondary education and career success. And we are planning on getting serious about this and monitoring as a student moves through grades K through 12 if they're on track to meeting that ultimate goal. You'll see at the bottom of the page our draft milestones. We've done a substantial amount of data modeling to try and identify if a student has a certain score on a college readiness assessment or on a state test in a certain grade, how well does that predict that they will be successful at the next step? Right now, we have a high percentage of students that are meeting state standards on the OAKS assessment in the early grades, and that percentage gradually drops off. And we know that those students that are not demonstrating proficiency at high school are not going to be college ready. So we've done the data modeling to identify what is a score at 11th grade or 10th grade or 8th grade that is predictive of them being successful in post-secondary education. And you can see in 10th grade, will you be using both a plan and the state reading test to identify those students that we believe are on track for being college ready. Finally, on pages 3 and 4, some examples of how we use the plan data in conjunction with other data to assess gains in student learning. And this is probably the key piece for our district, is that on page 3, you see some data from our TAG program evaluation that we conducted this year, and we're measuring growth of all students and our talented and gifted students as they move through the system. And so the state tests do not provide us annual measure of student growth between grades 8 and 9, 9 and 10, or 10 and 11, because the state test is only at grade 8 and grade 10. With a comprehensive system we have in place, we can measure how students are growing from grade 8 to grade 9, grade 9 to grade 10, grade 10 to grade 11, intervening with those students that are not being successful, and looking at how we can improve our program overall. So that first chart that you see, the first column, we have data that suggests that our talented and gifted students are making more progress in English, or in fact in any subject, from grade 8 to 9 and from grade 10 to 11 than our students overall. But there's a big difference in the amount of growth that our TAG students are experiencing at those different grades. And finally, the last page, we have used the plan data in conjunction with the ACT and Explore data in the evaluation of our mathematics program in 2008 and our science program in 2009, both to monitor the performance of students at a grade level, both as they progress from grade to grade and at the same grade level over time, as well as to determine if we are closing the achievement gap between different groups of students. So I thank you for the opportunity today to testify in support of Senate Bill 976, and I also would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Senator Moore.
Thank you. Ozzie, could you elaborate on the deliberations that occurred in the Board of Education when they adopted the essentially this waiver concept, as I understand it?
Madam Chair, Senator Morse, the board did not adopt the waiver. It was legislated in the 08 short session. The board this last March did adopt the language in 976. They support the concept of using the alternative test there. And they, in fact, as a board, testified in favor of this back when it was first dealt with in 2007. But they did not deliberate however you ask that question. It's a little different.
I understood that the board had looked at this and essentially signed off on it.
They did that in March on this specific language. But they have a history of supporting this concept clear back to when was initially dealt with in 2007.
Madam Chair, my question really focuses on, I guess, the intent of the testing. If it's college readiness and then progression of growth over time, that's one purpose. If the purpose is to norm against other districts, other schools, state of Oregon versus, you know, how we measure the job we're doing, and I would, don't want to put words in your mouth, but I would conclude based on the board's deliberation on this is that it's not used for comparison purposes between schools within the state.
Madam Chair, that is correct, and I think both the test makers would say the test isn't designed to be used that way.
Okay.
So I'd like to add one other comment. at the risk of insulting anybody, John used the words plan, explore. Those are the names of the tests that are delivered. Plan is used at grades, at grades 9 and 10, and explore is used at grade 8, I think.
Explore is grades 8 and 9.
8 and 9, okay.
And plan is 10.
At 10, and ACT is grade 11. They're normed differently, but that's when he's talking about plan and explore, that's what that was. And the second thing I'd like to draw to your attention, the list of 10 districts that I gave you that took the waiver, I gave you the size of them, and you'll notice that 5 of them are relatively large, above 10,000, and 5 of them are smaller, even down in Monroe with 440 sophomores. And so, actually, that's not four, that's 440 total ADM, I apologize, at Monroe. I just want on the table that both small and large districts got into this business before the state mandated it.
Senator Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a process question. Was the same bill introduced on the House side?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosenbaum, yes, ma'am. It was 2947.
What happened?
Well, I
was it heard?
Pulled the... Oh, yeah, it was heard, and there just never was a work session.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, other questions? Thank you very much. Representative Wingard, thank you for your patience. We went ahead without you. I understand you were testifying at another committee.
Fighting two battles at the same time.
Yes, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the Revenue Committee. I'm here on behalf of Representative Matt Winger from House District 26. I apologize. I am here on behalf of a school district within my district, Sherwood. And they have been using the ACT system now for a couple of years, and they do 8, 9, 10, and 11 with this ACT program, and are obviously very much interested in seeing that the waiver continues for them on those 10th grade scores. This is an extremely fine public school district. Last year, their dropout rate was zero. So I'm generally supportive of schools that are doing such a fine job of preparing their students for college and for the after high school experience, and very impressed with what Sherwood is accomplishing within their district. And I think that we generally, as a legislative body, ought to be encouraging schools that have found systems and ways that are helping them accomplish the goals, the broad goals that I think we all share for our kids. So I'm here in support of the bill, and I hope the committee will enthusiastically support it and allow districts that are using this model and getting tremendous success with it to continue.
Okay, thank you. Questions from the committee?
Just as a follow-up, Madam Chair. Zero dropouts with 4,862 students.
I'd be happy to put you in touch with the superintendent of Sherwood, Dan Jameson. He's an impressive man.
Unheard of.
It is unheard of. I think there's probably more to it than this test, would be my guess.
I'm sure.
All right. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
Okay. Now we have Matt Marquis. To the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Matt Marquis representing the College Board today. I don't want to get into a lot of the details of the PSAT, which is really the assessment that's in question here today, because I'm not an expert in the testing mechanisms of the PSAT. At this short notice of the hearing, I wasn't able to get somebody here that was an expert, but I do want to say that everything that you heard about as from PLAN or EXPLORE or those other types of tests, those are the same things that the PSAT sets out to do, and they were all taken account into the RFP process that you heard before the contract that was a statewide contract was awarded. Just to go back through the history of this, Representative Comp, Representative Dahlem, and others 2 years ago came up with this concept of allowing all students to take a 10th grade nationally normed assessment during the 2007 legislature, which set out to identify kids for college readiness, more advanced placement classes, And it focused on one contractor as the legislation was passed. It ended up passing, and last special session, well, actually in January of last year, January of 2008, the RFP was released, where a variety of assessments companies bid on that. It really boiled down to, I think, two, which was ACT and the College Board. In the special session of last year, February, ACT at the time, I believe, or at the request of ACT, there was legislation introduced looking for a waiver. This was before the RFP was awarded. The College Board initially was opposed to that concept of a waiver. Now, just to let you realize that there were ACT districts, there were College Board districts, there were districts on both sides of this issue, and yet while there was a chance of us losing this RFP, we didn't feel at that time that the risk was that these students would stop using our assessments anyway, and that's why we initially opposed the waiver laid out in the special session. Now, there were lots of discussions, lots of group meetings on the legislation, and essentially we came down to a one-year only waiver last special session, where Representative Roblin, Representative Comp, and Representative Buckley were all involved in that process. Most of this took place in the House Education Committee at the time. After that special session, the contract was then awarded, and the College Board was granted the bid in the contract. And again, all of those things that you heard about earlier, including price, were taken into account before the RFP was awarded. This year was the first year that the assessment was made available to all students. And as you heard, there were about 60%, give or take, of the students that took that. Some of the districts offered their test on Saturday. Some of them offered them on a Wednesday. And other districts took the waiver. Interestingly enough, there were 13 districts eligible to take the waiver, and 10 of them didn't. Or 10 of them did, excuse me. 3 of them did not take the waiver and made it work either with both tests or however they went through that process. We feel that this bill is an attempt to get around the legislation from 2 years ago, which was very specific in going out for a contract with one contractor, and we think that this kind of changes the rules of the contract after it was awarded, where the assessment company that was not awarded the RFP is now coming back trying to change the rules. As for the ESD issue that you heard about, now districts are paying twice for this. It wasn't our recommendation to take the money out of the ESD side of the state school fund. That was a policy choice made by legislators in this body, and if there was another place to find that money, that would be great. I don't know if there is this session, but that would then prevent those districts from paying twice if that is an argument of theirs. The other interesting thing is with this legislation, I believe, because the legislation requires all students the opportunity to take this nationally normed 10th grade assessment, and if you allow these waivers to continue, I think the department is going to find themselves in a position where they're going to have to track students because the tests are given in different days. And I believe Beaverton testified earlier saying that they offer plan the ACT version of this in the spring, whereas the PSAT is offered in the fall, and you have districts moving back and forth in between. And while it's maybe not a big percentage of students, you're still having students that, depending on where they move from an ACT district to a non-ACT district or whatever have you, where you're going to need to track those students to make sure they had the opportunity to take such an assessment. Again, there's nothing in current law today that prevents any district from continuing to do what they do now. They do have to pay for it, and we feel this here is just would allow for the payment of these assessments without going through the RFP process because we already had one and the contract was awarded, so we do think it's a change of the rules. But I'd be happy to answer any questions, Madam Chair.
Okay. Senator Morris, did you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I add up Mr. Rose's ADMW, it looks like we're about 111,000 students that are currently taking the ACT.
Ozzie, you have to come up if you're going to answer that.
Um,
Madam Chair, for the record, I'm Ozzie Rose. Sorry to interrupt, but the column you're adding, Senator, is the total ADM in those districts when I was trying to figure out what they lost in their ESD thing. The actual number of sophomores is, in that other table, there's 45,000 sophomores. 8,400 of them were tested in ACT districts last year.
Okay.
The other numbers, you add that up, that's Beaverton, they have 42,900 weighted ADM. But that's how they're paid. I was trying to show how that impacts what they receive from their ESD.
And Madam Chair, Senator Morse, that part of our argument here is that while that 8,400 students, I believe, is about 17 to 18% of these students, part of the when the RFP was placed or put out to bid, it was for all students, and assumptions were made on that bidding process for all students. And so this is taking a significant portion of those students out of the realm. And while it was testified earlier that the contract is a one-year contract up for renewal, it is an eight-year process, of which, at least it's my understanding, that it can be renewed for up to 8 years. So I don't think realistically this stuff would be opened back up to look at, and that's part of our argument there.
What's behind my question? I guess I'm trying to sort out how much of this is a financially driven issue and how much of it is, you know, what's in the best interest of students and the schools.
May I come in?
Mr. Marquis, your call.
Madam Chair, Senator Morse, I mean, both of us are free to comment, I guess, but... I think there's probably some of both. I mean, I think you have a contract that the legislature passed last session overwhelmingly and said we're going to do this with one contract. And I think if you were to talk to Representative Roblin and Representative Comp, they could express their opinions of why that's necessary. I'm not going to speak for them. There are some. There are a lot of legislators that, while it's not the place of the College Board to say that their data should be used for this, there are a lot of legislators that see this as a way to get statewide data. And when you take 20% out of them, that becomes more difficult to do because you have that's a large portion of the students not taking it. This year there was, you know, 60%, give or take, of the students that took the PSAT. I think that number is going to grow. And while the department didn't use that data this year, that doesn't mean that a year from now or 2 years from now they're not going to. I think by keeping the opportunity out there, there may be some possibilities of some educational benefits when you have that sort of data.
Mr. Rose, do you want to comment on that?
Madam Chair, if it's ever a decision by the State Board and other folks that they want to use this kind of data, they can stop offer. It's an annual waiver that is sought under the bill. So if that's decided, they don't give the waiver anymore, and everybody takes the same test. And Senator Morse's question about the contracts versus school and students, I want to make it very clear. I'm not here representing ACT. I'm here representing districts that got involved in this kind of testing before the legislature had the idea it was a good idea. And I think you should recognize that. The issue of the contract, if they test all the kids that are left over after the waiver district, it's 80-plus percent. And if that's not an adequate number,
under this bill,
they could renegotiate it, but I can't believe that it is an adequate number.
Well, but in the bill, as Steve just pointed out, says that you have the bill would require the waiver to be granted. So what you're saying is that the waiver could expire. And
it does. It's an annual waiver.
Right.
Yeah. You can't get it for it. You apply for it each year. Mm-hmm. And at any time, if the board decides that they want to do something different, they can do that.
Okay, Steve.
But, Madam Chair, if I may just comment on that briefly, it says in line 13 on page 2 that the department shall grant a waiver. So I don't know that it's a very discretionary waiver.
Yeah.
And I think the longer, with what it was just testified to, that's why we kind of came up with a compromise during the special session of a one-year waiver so that this wasn't an ongoing thing. And I think the longer you go through that process of granting a waiver year after year, I think it becomes harder and harder to move in that direction of statewide data.
Yeah, what's difficult about this is you have districts who feel that they get some real value out of this other testing, and it looks at some levels like kind of a war between the testing services. And
Madam Chair, I think there are a lot of districts that feel very passionate on both sides of the issue of different assessment companies. But again, this doesn't prevent anybody from continuing what they're doing.
Okay. Other questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anybody else here who wants to testify on this? Okay. With that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 976, or Senate Bill 976, and we will not be able to have a work session today on House Bill 2107, so we will carry that over until next Tuesday. We are waiting for an amendment. So, with that, that completes our agenda for the day. Be prepared for a couple of weeks of a lot of work in this committee. No more Mondays off, except next Monday, of course. So with that, we are adjourned.